Let's recite Om three times. Inhale. Om. Let's open the eyes. Do the invocation, and you can either keep the eyes closed, or if you want to read and sing along, you can do that. Inhale. Yogen chittasya paden vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakenam yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi Patanjalim Pranjaliranatosmi. So this is an invocation to sage Patanjali, who gave us the Yoga Sutras. You want to read the meaning loud?
The meaning?
Yeah.
I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda, of language, through his treatise on grammar, and the impurities of the chitta, through his treatise on yoga.
Okay, so these are the three things that Patanjali is given credit for. Okay. Ayurveda, grammar. His commentary is still considered to be one of the best commentaries on Panini's grammar. Okay, so, and then of course the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Okay. Were you here last time also?
No, last month I missed.
You've been here before, right?
No. You've never. First time. Yeah.
Okay. So, and this is only your second time?
Yes.
Okay. Now we have at least four or five people who have been coming regularly for the last 2 years. I don't see any one of them. So I don't know what happened.
Probably the weather.
Mm-hmm, that could be, yeah. But anyway, I think since most of, you know, all of you are relatively new now to this whole field, instead of jumping right into where I am, because that will confuse you, you know.
Oh, this is a continuation.
It's a continuation of the series that we've been doing for almost a year and a half now.
Oh.
Okay, and today, if we go through our slides that I plan to do today, it would be the last session of this entire series. Okay, we're coming to the close. But if we just stay with the introduction and overall review, then we might postpone the session that I plan to do today, which is okay. Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Sure. You don't have a problem.
Oh, yeah.
You must have.
Okay, now, so what we're doing is to just kind of go through the Yoga Sutras I have devised my own sequence, even though there are four chapters in the sutras. Okay, so let me just give you a brief introduction to the four chapters. The first chapter is called the Samadhi Pada. Samadhi Pada is a chapter. Pada is a foot, Pada is a quarter, Pada is a chapter. So, many different meanings. So, first chapter is called Samadhi Pada. Second is called Sadhana Pada. Third is called Vibhuti Pada. And the last one is called the Kaivalya Pada. The first chapter, which is Samadhi Pada, obviously talks about Samadhi. And also, it starts out by giving us the definition of yoga. What is yoga? And what are the goals and objectives of yoga? And how to attain those objectives, etc., etc. And then once you start attaining those objectives, what is Samadhi and what are the different stages and gradations of Samadhi? So that all that stuff is covered in the Samadhi Pada, which is chapter number 1. The chapter 2 starts out by giving us an understanding of what klesha is. Klesha is suffering. Klesha is all the pain, suffering, everything that we go through. In modern terminology, you can call it stress. So what is stress? What causes it? Then it goes into an explanation of the theory of karma, reincarnation, rebirth, etc., all that stuff. And finally tells us again, you know, what happens when the mind is controlled and what is it that we need to achieve through the practice of yoga. And eventually how to get there, he gives us the 8 limbs of yoga. He calls them the Ashtanga Yoga. Ashtanga Yoga, 8 limbs of yoga. And there he starts out with the 8 limbs of yoga, which are yamas, niyamas, and we will go through that very briefly now. Then the third chapter is called Vibhuti Pada, and he continues these 8 limbs of yoga because he wants to focus on meditation, which is the main part of the third chapter. So he shifts the final 3 limbs of yoga, which is all about the meditation part, into third chapter. And then third chapter is all about vibhutis. Vibhutis are supernormal powers that one can attain as a result of the practice of yoga. Powers like becoming very small, becoming very big, becoming very light, becoming very heavy, you know, ability to see beyond the walls, etc., etc. Lots of things are mentioned there. Many, many of these vibhutis, which can be attained as a result of the practice of yoga. When we say practice of yoga, it's all meditation, basically. You meditate deeply on something and then you attain this. You meditate deeply on something, you attain that. Obviously, you know, to do that kind of stuff, you have to, that deeply means very, very, very deep and long. You know, you have to practice for maybe many, many lifetimes before you can get there. Okay, so that's the part in the third chapter. Fourth chapter is called Kaivalya Pada, which goes a little more into the final state of yoga. It's called Kaivalya, that name that Patanjali uses for the final state of liberation, so to say. He calls it Kaivalya. Okay, so that last chapter goes more into that state and some different, depths of that whole state. So what we did, we started this series about, I think about a year and a half ago, maybe a little more, I forget now. And been going through almost every sutra by sutra by sutra. But I divided, I kind of sequenced them slightly differently, not necessarily the same sequence that Patanjali has, but that's more based on my own understanding how it will be more effective to sequence those. So that's what we've been doing. In the last few weeks, we have been studying chapter 2, which goes into depth about the whole Sankhya philosophy, and I'll come to that. So that's what we are doing right now, and this is where I wanted to finish, if you were to do that today. If we get there, we'll do that. Otherwise, we'll just talk about the basics. Okay, so today we are going back, because these people are new, and you are relatively new anyway. So we'll just go through the basic stuff today. So the whole, you know, the concept of yoga is to work on the mind. Yoga is all about the mind. It's to find out what's wrong with the mind and then tells us how to fix that mind. Everything is in the mind, right? When we say we are stressed out, where does it happen? Stress. It happens in the mind, right? Stress is a mental function. Everyone okay with that? Right? When we say I'm stressed out, that means my mind is not able to handle the situation that I'm put in face to face with. Now, if you recognize that stress is a mental function, right, then the question is, whose mind are we talking about? If I say I'm stressed out, whose mind is that? It's my mind. Very simple. If it is my mind, that means I'm talking of an entity that belongs to me. It's my mind. If it is my computer, it belongs to me. If it is my watch, it belongs to me. If it's my mind, I am the owner of that entity. I own it. That's the only way I can call it my mind. If I own something, if it's there's something that belongs to me, who should take care of it? Right? If it belongs to me, I should take care of it. Right? But when we say I'm stressed out, what happens generally? Right? I say, I'm stressed out because of you. My kids stress me out. My spouse stresses me out. It's the weather that's stressing me out. It's my boss that stresses me out. Everybody else stresses me out, which means everybody else is controlling my mind, whereas I claim it to be my entity. It's my property. I should be in charge, but I have given charge to everybody else except myself. Now, does that make sense? That's the first thing to recognize. You know, and I jokingly I talk about this term called, in software we call it outsourcing, right? You outsource the development software. Here you have outsourced the control of your own mind to everybody else. You open the doors and you've told everybody, please come and attack me because I want to be stressed. Why? Because I can point fingers at you now. Right? By pointing fingers, I feel good about it. I'm stressed out. I'm miserable. And yet, I like pointing fingers. You stress me out. You don't know how to behave in life. You don't know how to lead your life. You're making my life miserable. That's the normal situation. What's the message here? The message is, if it is your mind, let's learn how to control that mind. Let's learn how to keep it in a state that it never gets stressed out, no matter what happens. If it is in my control, if I know exactly how to handle this entity called the mind, I'll never get stressed out, no matter what anybody else does. Absolutely. Which means, what we're saying is, stress is my own creation. Stress is my own creation. It's my mind. I'm letting it happen. It's my own creation. And also we are saying, learning here, that nobody else can cause stress. Nobody can. Nobody has the power to cause stress to me. Now this is what Patanjali says. Klesha is your own creation. Klesha is the term he uses for all the suffering, all the pain, etc., etc. Right? So klesha happens because I have no idea what I'm doing, basically. Mind is out of my control. Mind, you know, what's mind? It's a function, right? It's a function, basically. Mind is a function. And every moment presents an experience to the mind. Every moment. You know, this class that we are attending now, it's an experience for the mind. Every experience eventually creates a memory in the mind. Every experience, right? It creates a memory. Now, there's an entity called the ego, ahankara in Sanskrit. What the ego likes to do with every experience, it also puts a little label alongside that experience. And the label would say something like, I like it, I hate it, I dislike it. Right? I love it, I hate it. I like it, I dislike it. Something like that. Right? It's going to put that. No matter what experience it is, you always find that label there. This meeting, for example, I was giving an example. There'll be a record of this meeting in your mind along with a label. I liked it, I disliked it. Always. The other label that the ego puts on that experience, just a little bit deeper, it says, I want this experience to repeat, or I never ever want to have this experience again in my life. So there is a sense of desire attached to that label. So there are two kinds of things that happen. So there is a pure memory, this thing happened, you know, on such and such date, it was a Saturday, and there were five people in the class, and the teacher was so and so. These are all factual things. That's pure memory, I call it. In Sanskrit, the term used is smriti, smriti, for this pure memory, smriti. See? And when you add that label to it, it's called sanskara or samskara, depending on where you're from. Sanskara or samskara. See? That label, that experience, whether it is liked or disliked, etc., etc. Sanskar. And the other label that we put was whether I want to have that experience again or not. That is called vasana. Just minor shades of differences, but that's the term they use. When you attach a little desire to it, I eat a piece of cake, I like it. Okay? I put that label, liked it, loved it. Right? And then I also put a label there, I want it again. Desire. Okay? So, because of that, that desire grows, and then you want that cake again, you have that cake again, and it keeps going in that cycle, that becomes a habit. Right? Some people, for example, I'm just giving a weird example, they go to a store, nobody's watching, let me steal this. Right? They like it. Nobody was able to find it out. They go home. They enjoy whatever they stole. Now there's a desire there. Let's try and repeat it. Let me go to another store and see if I can do the same thing. Nobody's watching. And it becomes a habit. You become a habitual stealer. Right? People become habitual about everything. Telling lies, criticizing others. All this happens because of these same things. Every experience has a memory. You will attach a label to it, and then you start repeating those things. They become habits. That's what's called sanskara. Right? So this becomes your sanskara. So to understand the mind, you know, they say that you should think of the mind as having four functions. Okay, four functions in the mind itself. What are these four functions? One is called just the mind, manas in Sanskrit. Manas is the mind which does all the cognition, all the input receiving through the five senses. That's called manas function. The second function is, what are the other things mind does?
Analyze.
Analyze and make a decision as to, you know, picking from options, right? Analyze the situation, then given the options, you pick one from many options that are your offer. That function is called buddhi. Buddhi. You heard these terms before? Somewhat, right? Buddhi is the intellect, it's called the intellect. So there's manas and there's buddhi. What else does the mind do? We just talked about all these functions, basically.
Memory.
Memory. There's a big function of the mind, memory. Okay. It's in this context, it's called chitta. That memory is called chitta. And finally, the function is?
Attachment or desire.
No, I called it the ego.
Okay.
Ego is the one which tells me, you know, I like it, I dislike it, I want it, you know, let's do it again, etc., etc., etc. That's the ego, ahankara. There is manas, buddhi, ahankara, and chitta. Those are the four functions that are you. If you read any text, you know, that's what they'll tell you. These are the four functions of the mind. Okay? So how does it all work together? You know, again, let's take that example of a cake. You're at the end of the day's work, you're coming back from your office and you're a little bit hungry, you're driven to the kitchen side, you know, and as soon as you close, as you enter the kitchen or close to it, you start smelling something nice, and you're driven to that sense. This is the manas function I'm talking about, manas function, because mind is supposed to gather all the information through the five senses, right? So the first sense that's getting engaged in this case is the sense of smell. So you go to the cake and you look at it, sense of sight getting engaged, you know, and then you want to dip your finger, just feel the texture, getting the sense of touch engaged, and then of course you want to put it in your mouth, put it on your tongue, the sense of taste is engaged, etc., etc. So now the mind, the manas has all the information, and the next task is to make a decision. Analyze the situation and make a decision. So who does that?
Ego.
No. Normally, we said buddhi is the analyzer, right? Intellect. Buddhi is the analyzer, decision maker, discriminatory function, so to say, buddhi. Okay, so it all goes to... So the mind says, buddhi, please tell me what I should do, basically. That's the whole idea. So the manas says, buddhi, please guide me. Now, the situation is such that in the current state of my mind, buddhi is unable to make independent decisions because it is controlled by the ego. That's just how the facts are in life. Okay, so buddhi is actually going to go and knock ego's door. Hey, boss, tell me what I should do. I have all this information. What do I do now? Ego says, okay, let me do some investigation, analysis. Ego does its own analysis. It goes into the memory and picks up an instance which was, you know, the same cake that we had a week ago. And the label is?
Yummy.
Yummy, divine. You know, the label says delightful, yummy, divine. So ego says, it's very simple. You know, and the next label, vasana, was, yes, I want that repeat performance. So he says, tell the mind to activate the motor actions, grab the, you know, extend the hand, and do whatever it needs to do. Okay. Now, when it comes back to the intellect says, hey, look, I'm the decision maker. I need to do some private investigation. I'm not happy, you know. I need to do my own investigation. So it goes into the memory. All the investigation is done based on the memory only. There's nowhere else you can go. Pulls up some other instance, somewhat related. What is that? A visit to the doctor just about 4 days ago, and based on the blood work, I found, the doctor found that my cholesterol levels are dangerously high, and I'm almost close to having a heart problem. Okay? And the doctor had advised me to go to a nutritionist, which I did 3 days ago, and guess what she told me?
No cake.
Okay? Now the intellect is very worried, you know. Intellect says, boss, 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 ego, right? He says, this is what I find. I'm not supposed to eat the cake because my cholesterol levels are extremely dangerously high. Guess what the ego says? Okay. You stupid idiot, don't you read the label? It says divine experience, absolutely yummy and delightful. And one piece of cake, do you think it can do any harm to anybody? Just one piece of cake. If it is so beautiful, just let's just enjoy this piece of cake. We'll worry about, these doctors don't know anything anyway, you know, let's enjoy this. Only I have only one life to live, so let me enjoy it. Let's do that. Right? So this is how the whole thing functions. You get the picture, right? You have the entire message now. A week later we might be in the hospital, but that's okay. So these are the four functions of the mind: manas, buddhi, ahankara, and chitta. And in our current state of affairs, most of the time the ahankara is the dominating factor. It does not allow the buddhi to make independent decisions. Okay, that's how life is right now. And that's what's causing all the suffering, all the pain that we go through, all the stresses that we go through, is because the ego is the deciding factor. It's the ego says that darpan is the person who's causing all the problems in my life. You know, if she knew how to behave, I wouldn't have all these problems. Ego loves to do that, so it keeps doing it. Beautiful, life goes on, I'm suffering, I keep suffering, I get all kinds of health problems. Aaj stomach ache ho gaya, kal ko diarrhea ho gaya, person, you know, this ho gaya, wo ho gaya. I hope it's okay to speak a little bit of Hindi, because it's all from India, you know. or Nepal, anyway. Okay, so this is how life is. So what's the problem and what's the solution? So how can you paraphrase the problem? What is the problem?
How to reduce ahankara?
Problem is that ahankara is dominant, and solution is
controlling.
Shift the control from the ahankara to the buddhi. Very simple. Right? So you have to shift the control from ahankara to buddhi, so that, like, you know, she said that there are two things, right? In the Upanishad, you know, they use the two terms for what you just said. One is called prayas, and one is called shreyas. Prayas, shreyas. You heard these terms, right? That's what he was talking about. Prayas is something that is pleasant to us. This cake is prayas.
Instant gratification.
Instant gratification. Prayas. Shreyas is something that is desirable. In this case, avoiding the cake is desirable. That is shreyas. Prayas is the cake itself. Eating the cake is prayas. Ego always picks the prayas. Always. If we transfer the control to the buddhi, it knows not to pick the prayas, but only to pick the shreyas. You get the idea? And if you know the distinction, the key is that we don't know the distinction. We get confused whether it is prayas or whether it is shreyas, because we are so muzzled up, we are so messed up. Our ego and intellect, they keep playing games with each other. It's always in a state of confusion. And the mind doesn't know what to do. It says, okay, you tell me. And they too keep fighting with each other, you know, the intellect and the ego. And confusion, utter confusion happens, and sometimes you do the right thing, sometimes you do the wrong thing. Most of the time, it is the wrong thing. Okay, so the objective is to what they call sharpen the intellect. And one of the Upanishads, it says it should be sharp like a razor's edge. There's an Upanishad called the Kathopanishad. It says the intellect has to be sharpened enough so that it becomes like a razor's edge. And any element of the ego that comes in, it can, because of the razor's edge, it can cut it right away. So if ego tries to tread the path of the intellect, tries to take over, that razor edge is so sharp, ego has no way of getting there. That's what the Upanishad says.
So is ahankara always bad?
It's the negative part of the ahankara. See, there are four functions. Manas, buddhi, ahankara and chitta. All these four functions are absolutely necessary for living and survival. Without the ego, I will have no idea who I am. That identification will be lost. That's the main job of the ego. To tell me that at this given time I am the mother, therefore I should do that. At this present time I am the boss. At this time I am a co-worker. At this time, you know, I am a shopper. That's the ego's function. It has to identify the job properly and, you know, your own identification. It has to do that. Without that, nothing will function. But it's the labeling that is causing the problem. Ego loves to put those labels. And then when the action is driven by those labels rather than the pure memory, that's when problems happen. That's the main problem here. So the definition of yoga, I'm just coming back, you know, this is just kind of the basic background. So in the very first chapter, the second sutra says the definition of yoga is yoga chitta vritti nirodhaha. That is Sanskrit phrase. Okay, you want to repeat that after me? Is it okay? Yoga chitta vritti nirodhaha. What does it mean? Yoga is yoga. Chitta is the mind. Chitta is the whole mind complex, as they say. Vritti is what is happening in the mind. Vritti, whatever is in the mind at any given time, whatever changes are going on, that's vritti. And nirodha is control or, you know, subdue it or cessation, all those kind of things. So yoga chitta vritti nirodha, that means yoga is by definition the ability to control all the changes that are happening in the mind. That's yoga. It's a very simple definition. It's all about controlling the mind, calming the mind, stilling the mind's activities, being the very still and peaceful. Because it's only then, so what happens then after that, it says, when that happens, tada, the next one is tada, drashtuhu, swarupe vasthanam. So tada, drashtuhu, swarupe vasthanam. What does that mean? Drashtuhu is, drashta means the one who sees, drashta. Drishya is something that is seen, drashta is one who sees. Okay. So tada means then, in Sanskrit, tada means then, at that time, after the mind has been calmed down, then drashta, the seer, the observer, swarupe avasthanam. Swarupe means in his own swarup. Swarup means your own true nature, your true identity. Then the drashta finds its own true identity. That still doesn't make sense, right? That sentence?
It does.
What does it mean?
I think it means you identify your soul.
That's very true. So drashta here is the soul, is the atma. Because what Patanjali says, that our true identity is the soul. This body, this mind, this intellect is all given to us as an enclosure to this soul so that we can experience life. Okay? So that's the whole idea. We experience life. We want to live life. After all, we've been given birth here, so we need to live life. And to do that, we need this body, mind, etc., so that we can function in life. But that's not our true identity. Our true identity is the soul, is the atma, so to say. And that, in yoga terminology, that's called purusha. Purusha. Purusha is the soul. Okay? And everything else, this body, intellect, mind, and the whole other material stuff that we have, that's called prakriti. So there is purusha and there is prakriti. So all this material stuff, which includes our mind and intellect and body and everything, that's prakriti. And the stuff that the only entity that has consciousness is the purusha. The buddhi, the intellect, functions based on consciousness, which is borrowed from purusha, they say. By itself, it has no consciousness, buddhi. It functions because it borrows consciousness from purusha. Okay? So it says that yogas chitta vritti nirodhaha, chitta, mind's, yoga by definition is calm the mind, keep the mind peaceful, serene, subtle, calm. And when that happens, the drashta or the soul find its own true identity. Otherwise, it's confused. Otherwise,
it just goes by prakriti.
Then, itaratra. Then the last one is in the definition. Okay, vritti sarupyam itaratra. Vritti sarupyam itaratra. Itaratra means otherwise. Itaratra means otherwise. So otherwise, if the mind is controlled, then the atma finds its true nature, it finds itself. Okay? Otherwise, vritti sarupyam. Vrittis are whatever is happening in the mind, everything that is changing in the mind, whatever in the mind. Sarupyam means that rupa, that it takes that shape. Otherwise, it is confused by the mind. Basically, that's what it is mean. By the changes, by whatever is happening, by any image that happens in the mind, any thought, it is going to be shaped by that. It's going to be confused and shaped by that. That means then the ego takes over and you are miserable. So the definition of yoga is that you learn how to calm the mind. If you do that, you'll be happy because you will know who you are. If you don't do that, then you will never know who you are, and your ego stays in control, and ego is going to drive you nuts all your life.
You said labeling is the main cause of many problems, but that is also part of learning, right? That is key to learning. That is key to learning process also, labeling.
Yes, yes.
You go near a snake, it bites you, and you remember the back.
Yes, absolutely.
So you can't get rid of it completely.
No, you cannot. Again, what is it that we are picking out of it? Is it the labeling which was done purely as a like and dislike? Or it was, see, there are two things happening now. When the snake bites or when you touch a very hot plate, okay, that label again goes there. But that label is done by the intellect. Because intellect wants to make sure that you don't repeat it. Okay? It's not done by the ego then. Now, intellect knows what the labels are put by the intellect. Okay? Because that's a very pragmatic approach. You don't want to touch this hot plate again. Alright? That's done by the intellect, that labeling. That's perfectly okay. We want to avoid the labeling which is done by the ego. That's basically it.
Experience, can both label that? Both ego and
It can happen. Sure, yeah. It can happen. That's where the prayas and shreyas will come in.
I want to test the limits of how hot to touch.
Your ego says, go ahead. You can do it.
Yeah. That prayas and shreyas may use the labels, but then it will be the label used by the intellect, which will be, you know, which would allow us to pick the shreyas, and it's the label picked by the ego which will make us pick prayas. So yes, both can happen. Same time, absolutely. Okay, so that's how the chapter 1 starts in the Yoga Sutras, Samadhi Pada. Then Patanjali goes into a description of the vrittis, you know, 5 vrittis. What are the things that cause this change in the mind? Okay. And then he goes into these 5 of them, they're called Pramana, Viparyaya, Vikalpa, Smriti and Nidra, 5 of them. I'm not going to spend time on that today. Okay. So that's how the mind changes constantly, moment to moment. Every moment it changes because of these 5 vrittis. And very quickly, these are, how do you get right kind of knowledge? How do you get confused kind of knowledge? How do you get imaginary knowledge? How do you get information from the memories and from sleep? So those are the 5 kind of things which can modify your mind at every moment in life. So they are called vrittis. Okay? And then he says 2 very important statements. He says to calm the mind, eventually you need these 2 things, abhyasa and vairagya. Abhyasa and vairagya. What is abhyasa?
Learning.
Exercise.
Study.
Trying.
Study.
Abhyasa.
Learn.
Exercise. Repetition.
Repetition, yes. Practice. Practice is abhyasa. Practice. You know, Sanskrit words can find slightly different shades of meaning in local vernacular, right? You know, in Marathi, same Sanskrit word can find a slightly different meaning. In Punjabi, it can find a slightly different meaning, etc. It happens all the time. But the original meaning of what abhyasa is practice. But even in Sanskrit, the meaning can change depending on the context. Each word can have multiple meanings. Okay? So, abhyasa and vairagya. Patanjali gives a very nice definition of abhyasa. He says abhyasa has 3 attributes. 3 attributes. What are these 3 attributes? He defines it as dirghakala, nairantarya, satkara sevitaha. 3 attributes of abhyasa. What is dirghakala?
Long term.
So the practice has to be done for a very long time. Dirghakala. Nairantarya.
Without
any interruption. No antara. Antara is interruption, gaps. Antara means gaps. No gaps, no interruption. Nairantarya. Satkara sevitaha. Satkar means?
Respect,
devotion. You know, total sense of commitment, devotion, respect. That's satkar. Asevitaha. Sevanam means to practice, to experience something, to practice something. Asevitaha means it's done, it is practiced with a lot of devotion, a lot of respect and commitment and faith, trust, whatever words you want to use. So to do whatever you're doing to make it effective and meaningful, that practice has to be done for a very, very long time. And since the goal of yoga is so difficult to attain, the goal of yoga, as we said, is to calm the mind. Given that it is so difficult to attain, Patanjali says the long time would mean multiple lifetimes. It cannot happen in one lifetime. That's long term. That's dirghakala. Dirghakala, in the case of yoga, you know, it can mean multiple, it will mean multiple lifetimes.
We are talking about multiple lives. Is it the soul that remembers?
Yes. Well, we'll come to that. Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. Yes. That's all a part of chapter 2. It's all given in chapter 2, how that happens. But we'll get to that quickly. So, but there's dirghakala. Nairantarya means no interruptions. You have to absolutely practice it, you know, very, very regularly. Okay? And then do it with a sense of devotion, sense of trust and faith, etc. That means if you're practicing yoga, do it for a long time without any interruption and trusting that it is something good for you, something that will lead you to that calmness of the mind. Do that with that satkar, you know. Okay? So that's abhyasa. And then vairagya is what?
Conviction.
No, vairagya is not conviction. No. Vairagya?
No, what?
Mm-hmm. I thought vairagya is conviction.
What do you mean conviction? Explain.
Having that
determination
or something like that.
No. Vairagya means detachment. Vairagya.
But that comes with determination, right?
Detachment is...
No, determination is different. Yeah. They're not connected. Again, it might have... You know, that term can change its meaning in the local lingo, but vairagya means detachment. Raga means attachment. Raga. Raga means attachment. And vairagya means, it means both non-attachment as well as detachment. Both. Okay. So, the difference is that, I'm attached to this coffee, for example, at 4 in the afternoon. I'm attached to that. That's attachment, right? I'm already attached to it. But now, I've realized that it's not a good thing for me. I need to detach myself from it. That's detachment. So, you want to develop vairagya when you're already attached to something. Okay? And non-attachment is... I don't drink any coffee. My friend told me, let's try it out. I tried it. It feels good. I liked it. But I don't want to get attached to it. That's non-attachment. Just a minor difference.
Proactive and after the fact.
That's very good. Yes, you can put it that. Reactive and proactive. Okay, you're deciding not to attach yourself to something because you know that it's not going to be very good for you. But now... Having learned that something is not good for me and I'm attached to it, how do you pull yourself apart from it? That's detachment. Both these terms mean the same thing in Sanskrit, vairagya. All right? So, Patanjali says there are two kinds of grades of detachment. You know, he calls them lower detachment and upper detachment, so to say. Okay, higher level. So, the lower level of non-attachment, he says, is when you can completely detach yourself from any attachment through the five senses. No attachment. Right? If I like this piece of cake, I like it, no problem with that, I'm not attached to it. If I don't get it next week, I'm perfectly happy.
That is the lower level.
Yes. That's the lower level of attachment. That means I am not going to be attached to any of the five senses. Any of the five senses. Sense of touch, smell. I listen to some music, I love it, but I'm not going to be attached to it. If I don't hear that music next time, it's okay. I love to hear my son's voice, but if I don't hear that voice for a week, I'm okay. That's the lower, that's what got me when I first started reading it. This is the lower level? Is he kidding?
What is the upper level? the basement right now.
So the higher level of detachment, he says, there are three things, there are three gunas. Anybody heard the term gunas? Sattva, rajas and tamas?
Oh, yes.
You heard those terms, right? There are three gunas. Everything in this prakriti is a composite of these three gunas. Sattva is purity, rajas is action, and tamas is all the negative stuff, dullness, sleepiness and all that stuff. Everything in our mind, at every given time, we have one of these three gunas which is dominant. Okay? You came to this class probably because you have sattva dominant. You know, some people stayed back because either their tamas was dominant or they decided to go to a movie because rajas was dominant. Who knows?
What's rajas?
Action. Gung-ho. Type A active personality. On the go. That's rajas. Desire, ambition, you know, all that is controlled by rajas. I want to be the CEO of this company. That's rajas. Okay. And sattva is all purity, calm, you know, very peaceful, loving, tender, compassionate, you know, those good stuff. And tamas is all dark side, you know, where you're either very dull, you're very sleepy, you don't want to think, you say my brain is fried, you want to be a couch potato, you just want to sit and watch football, eating French fries and all that stuff, you know. Or you want to do something bad, you want to kill somebody or shoot somebody or rob a bank or do terrorism, all that is tamas. Combined with some rajas, obviously, you know. So these are the three gunas which make up all our actions. Every moment we act based on these three gunas. And there is a state which is considered perfect balance of these gunas. In fact, originally, everything was in a state of perfect balance before any creation was given to us. Before the human being is born, so to say, it's in a perfect state of balance. What is that state? We don't know. I mean, what that balance is, what proportion is, we don't know. But that's the state called the balanced state. But as the gunas constantly change, now at this time in my life, at this moment, for example, every guna is changing, you know, there's constant change going on every moment. Okay? But the point is, can we go and do something so that these gunas get completely balanced. So I am not attached to these gunas also. I'm not even attached to sattva, for example. People say, you know, I have to have sattva so that rajas and tamas are less dominant, so I can do good things in life. I'm not supposed to be attached even to that eventually. When I come to that state, that's the highest state of detachment or non-attachment. And it's only that state that can lead us to final liberation.
Samadhi.
Final liberation. Kaivalya. Beyond samadhi. Kaivalya. So these are the two things that Patanjali says you have to do, abhyasa and vairagya, so that you can eventually learn how to calm the mind. Right? And then in chapter 1, of course, he goes into great depth of explaining what these samadhi states are. There are different stages of samadhi he describes, and you know, we're not going to do that today. You know. He's keeping it more at a simplistic level today. Okay? And there's also a concept introduced in the chapter 1 itself. It's the concept of Ishvara. Ishvara. What's Ishvara?
God.
Ishvara is God. Okay. So, Patanjali says that Ishvara is... He gives a very precise definition. Very precise definition. So, his definition of Ishvara is Klesha, karma vipakashayaihi aparamrishtaha. That's a very, very precise definition. Aparamrishtaha means untouched, completely unaffected by what? Klesha, no suffering, no stress whatsoever, ever, never. Karma, there is no karma, there is no karma phala, there is no rebirth, no recycling. Okay, klesha, karma, vipaka. Because there is no karma, there is no vipaka. Vipaka means karma phala, getting the results of karma. Ashaya is all the baggage of karma. All this bag that we carry from life to life. That's what your question was, and we'll come to that. So this Ishvara is completely free of all this. It's a pure entity which absolutely never goes through any of this. My soul, even though it is pure in its pure form, in its pure, but otherwise it gets corrupted by the ego. And because it is corruptible by the ego, it goes through all this. It goes through rebirth, it goes through recycling, it goes through klesha, suffering, stress, likes and dislikes, all that happens. Okay. But this Ishvara is so clean, so pure, so untouched, it never goes through any of this. It's the epitome of perfection. The most perfect being. Absolutely the most perfect being. And because it's the most perfect being, it has anadi. Anadi means?
No beginning.
It's ananta.
No end.
Okay? And then Patanjali also says that he is the teacher of all the teachers. Even the most ancient teachers were taught by Ishvara, or they got their knowledge, wisdom from Ishvara. He's the teacher of all the teachers. He's the supreme being. And then also he mentions that Ishvara is represented by this sound Om. Ishvara is represented by the sound Om, and therefore he says that you should chant the sound of Om to keep this Ishvara in your mind, because it's the most perfect being, and you want to eventually emulate that perfect being in your own life. You want to make your life such that you also become free of klesha, karma, vipaka, and all that. So that's the kind of the concept of Ishvara he presents.
What did you say about Om?
Om is the sound that represents Ishvara. It says, this sutra is very simple. It says, Tasya Vachakaha Pranavaha. Tasya Vachakaha is a representative sound. Representative Vachakaha. And Pranava is the Om sound. Yeah, bring whatever helps you, please. That feeling went away? This.
Yeah.
You felt
I
okay?
I generally have that very regular, but it stays for like 10 to 15 minutes.
But you felt okay after that?
Yeah. But I couldn't stand, I had to sit.
That's perfect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, what the best would be for you is to put this chair in front and put your feet on your chair.
That's okay.
That might actually be better.
So she's just feeling.
No, I don't want to face my feet towards you.
No, don't worry about that. You know, that's not at all. I don't mind that.
Okay.
Anything that helps you. I just think it'll be easier.
That's from all of that.
I knew that would help, but you know, that's something.
Yeah, the blood circulation.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll definitely help. And you may want to actually sit on a small cushion. That'll also help you.
I'm comfortable.
You're okay now?
Yeah.
Okay. Pranavaha. So I was saying that Tasya Vachakaha Pranavaha. That's the statement. Tasya means Ishvara. His representative sound is Pranava. Pranava is Om sound. Right? Pranava is Om sound.
Okay.
pranabhava. And then it says, tad japas tadartha bhavanam. That means, you should do the japa of Om with its meaning in mind, artha bhavanam. Artha means the meaning, and bhavanam is to keep that in mind. So you should do the japa of Om sound with its meaning in mind. What is the meaning? Meaning is that it represents Ishvara. What is Ishvara? Ishvara is that perfect being which never goes through any change. As opposed to this Purusha, this Atma, this soul that goes through change all the time. Because of its attachment or identification with the ego. See, all the dots are connecting together now. Right? So that's the whole concept of Ishvara that's presented. The reason he presents it, he says that you should, because of its perfection, the term he uses is Ishvara Pranidhana. Pranidhana means a deep sense of surrender, a deep sense of devotion, surrender with devotion. That you should surrender your ego in favor of this Ishvara who is all perfect, all knowing, teacher of all teachers, etc., etc. Multiple Purushas, multiple Atmas. In yoga philosophy, every Purusha is an individual Purusha. Ishvara is only one. Okay, Purushas are multiple, you know. My Purusha is separate.
There are so many names of God. Every religion and different God and different way of, you know.
I'm God.
Okay. So let's move on, you know, and then, like I said, in chapter 2, he talks about all these terms related to klesha. Klesha is suffering, and he says the main cause of klesha is ignorance, main reason, ignorance about not knowing who I am. Because I don't know who I am, ego takes over. And so that's the next cause of all my suffering. Ego is the one which causes all the suffering. Then ego creates all these likes and dislikes, as we said. So he calls them avidya. Avidya is ignorance. And the term he uses for ego is asmita. Asmita. So avidya, asmita. Then likes and dislikes are raga and dvesha. The Sanskrit terms he uses. Raga and dvesha. And when we have all these likes and dislikes, what does it lead to? Fears of all kinds. And that term he uses, abhinivesha. So it's avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. Abhinivesha means that I'm afraid of change. I want to maintain status quo. I want to be where I am. I don't want to do anything new, anything different. I'm scared. Because I like what I do now. It's written in my label. I like it. I want it again. I like this cup of coffee at this time. I don't want to change it. I'm afraid. And ultimately, they say it's the final fear of death. That's the worst change that people can think of. Death. Most dangerous change in life, so we are all afraid of that. So it's the desire to maintain status quo. That means my desire is to maintain this life the way it is. I don't want to die, or I don't want to make any change in my life. I'm okay because of these likes and dislikes. That obviously deprives us of all the fun and adventure and, you know, learning new things and going new places and everything. You know, we just don't want to do that. And when all that happens, we are suffering. The main cause of that suffering is the ego. The main cause of the suffering is the ignorance, not knowing who I am. It's the identification of the Purusha, of the Atma with this prakriti, with the buddhi, with the ego.
I think ignorance, and I'm thinking more like ignorance is about the mind. It's like there's a game going on and you don't know the game. That is the problem. Once you know the game, maybe it's better.
So the game is that the name of this game in yoga is that Purusha Atma is not identified with the ego. I don't know that game. I don't know that rule, so I'm confused. So I'm identifying the Purusha with this Prakriti, and therefore I'm confused. That's the ignorance part.
So not knowing the different players and how they play.
In this case, the two main players are Purusha and Prakriti. I don't know their identity separately. I'm confused. I'm identifying them together and I'm messing up everything with the ego. And that's why, you know, I'm suffering.
The clarity of thought is key.
That doesn't come unless... That's right. Clarity of thought.
Knowledge. So knowledge gives.
But how did the soul come into being to begin with?
Well, you know, according to yoga, right, the yoga concept is all derived from this philosophy called Sankhya. Now, according to this, Purusha and Prakriti, Purusha is the soul and Prakriti is the material being. Okay? And both are anadi, they are beginningless. There is no question ever asked, how did they come into being? That's not the question. Because they were always there. That's just how it is.
Now, how do I understand that I am taking multiple births? My soul is going through this journey. But it started somewhere and it did some bad karma, so it's again and again going through that. Mm-hmm. So somewhere that was broken, that individual soul was there, right? So I'm just trying to trace where...
Again, you know, they also say that this avidya is also anadi. So we were born with this avidya. This lack of knowledge that I am separate from this body and mind, that is also anadi. That's also beginningless, that avidya. The Purusha is anadi and ananta. Prakriti is anadi and ananta. Avidya is anadi, but it's not ananta. It can have an end. And that's the end that we're looking for. Okay? Now, the question that you are raising, there is no answer to that question, unfortunately. That question has been raised multiple times since the day one. There is no answer to that. Because if you look at yoga philosophy, it says they are both anadi, both anant. There is no question.
Like I asked last time, why would God create a soul, or rather introduce a soul into this pure soul into this Prakriti and then make it go through so many births, rebirths, for what? Hamster on a wheel.
Well, according to the Sankhya, there is only, it doesn't go beyond that. You know, Sankhya doesn't go into even into Ishvara. He doesn't mention Ishvara at all. It's Patanjali who has picked that term. Okay, it's just Purusha and Prakriti, just two entities. And they are too independent, they are too separate, but they need each other for creation and all that good stuff. Okay. Now, the cycle has been going on right from the beginning. That's how it is. That's how it is explained. It's a beginningless cycle. You know. And to answer your question, you know, there is something called there are three kinds of bodies, they say. There is a sukshma sharira. Okay. Do you know these three? There is a sthula sharira, there is sukshma sharira, and there is karana sharira. They call the gross body, subtle body, and the causal body in English. Okay. Causal. Cause. Karana sharira. Okay. Sthula sharira is this physical body, five elements. Five elements are earth, water, air, fire and ether, right? Five elements. This whole physical body is composed of these five elements, right? We all know that. Right? That's called the sthula sharira. And also these, you know, then there are five sense perceptions, sense of smell, touch, taste, etc. And then five sense organs. One organ is associated with one of the sense perceptions. For example, the nose is a sense organ, which is associated with the sense of smell. The ear, associated with the sense of hearing. Skin, sense of touch, etc., etc. You know that. Okay? So they call them 23 elements. There are 23 elements that we are made of. We are made up of 23 elements. There are the five gross elements. We know that, right? Five gross elements. Earth, water, air, fire and ether. Right? They are called Mahabhuta. Anybody heard the term? Mahabhuta. Pancha Mahabhuta. Then we have the five senses, sense perceptions, hearing, touch, taste, smell and all that. Then five sense organs. That makes it 15. Then there are five organs of action. Karma Indriyas they call, Karma Indriyas. These five organs are called Jnana Indriyas. And then there are five Karma Indriyas. Karma is the action. What are these five? For pulling stuff, pushing stuff, lifting stuff, that's the hand and arms. That's one. For kicking, running, walking, okay, that's the feet and legs. That's number two. For abusing somebody, you know, telling others that you are the most biggest idiot and all that, there's the tongue. That's the organ of action, most dangerous organ of action. Right? And then there are two others which are elimination, organs of elimination and organs of procreation. So you know that. Okay, so there are the five organs of action. So that makes it 20 so far. And then they have the other three that we talked about. Ahankara, Manas and Buddhi. So we are a composite of these 23 elements. Okay? And then of course there is the Prakriti which is the unmanifest or the Prakriti which was there before this creation happened. That's called the unmanifest. And if you add Purusha, you can call it 25 elements. It depends. Okay? So, the point is that in this whole understanding of who we are, according to the Sankhya philosophy, which was borrowed by Patanjali, there are only two entities, Purusha and Prakriti, and they are both Anadi and both Ananta. Patanjali added the element of Ishvara, because I'm assuming at that time in the society, Ishvara was popular, you know, because other philosophies have Ishvara in that context, God, you know, Bhagwan. So he added that, okay, to this Ishvara Pranidhana. Okay? But the whole concept there is that we want to sharpen the mind, sharpen the intellect, so that the intellect takes over and the ego is put in its own place. Ego is told to do its job, but not raise its head beyond it, what it is supposed to do. That's the whole purpose. Okay, so that's the main idea behind the practice of yoga. All right, are we okay up to so far? So what does he do? So he says that I'll give you a formula how to do all that. Eight limbs of yoga. He calls it Ashtanga Yoga. So Patanjali says, my formula for you guys is Ashtanga Yoga. Okay? And he introduces that Ashtanga Yoga with a very beautiful sutra. Okay? So he's, you know, again the Sanskrit phrase is Yogang Anushthanat Ashuddhikshaye Jnana Deeptihi A Vivek Khyatehe. Okay? What does it mean? Yogang Anushthanat. Yoganga, these eight limbs of yoga, Anga is limbs of yoga. Anushthan means practice. Okay. So through the practice of these eight limbs of yoga, those are the first two words, yoganga anushthanat, ashuddhi kshaye. What is ashuddhi? Impurities. And kshaye means?
Get rid of.
So, through the practice of these eight limbs of yoga, that's the first thing that will happen. Your impurities will be reduced or diminished or eliminated. What are we talking about here? Impurities of what?
Mind, body, emotion.
Mind, body, everything. What are the impurities of the mind?
Raga, dvesha.
Klesha.
All the kleshas, raga, dvesha. You know, there are six terms called, you know, you've heard these six enemies, they're called kama, krodha, lobha. Anybody heard those terms? Kama, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsarya. You heard these terms? Kama is what?
Desire.
Lust. Craving. Strong desire for something. Lustful craving, call it. Eh? Kama. Krodha? Anger. Lobha?
Greed.
Moha? Moha also means
negative
wantingness, not knowing the truth. That's moha is delusion. I'm not sure what's the right thing, what's wrong thing. You know, moha. Mohit ho gaya means he is deluded. He doesn't know for no reason. You know, you're getting attracted to something and you don't know what the reality is, but you just want something. That's moha. Mada is. Ego, arrogance, mother. Oh, I'm supreme. Who the hell are you? Yeah, that's mother. And matsarya?
Matsarya is envy.
Jealousy, envy.
Jealousy.
Yeah, okay. So all these are enemies of the mind, of the human, you know. And this is what the impurities are. All these kleshas and raga, dvesha. Everything is an impurity of the mind. So he says, yoganga anushthanat ashuddhi kshaye, on the removal of these impurities. Kshaye means on the removal of. Okay. What happens? Jnana deeptihi. What's jnana deeptihi? Light of true wisdom shines through. Jnana deeptihi. Light of true wisdom. Jnana is here true uncluttered wisdom, you know, pure wisdom. That light will shine through now. And what does that light do to us? Viveka khyati. Viveka is pure discrimination. Pure viveka. When I have viveka, that means I know exactly what's right and what's wrong. I know that.
Clarity.
Perfect clarity of thought. At that point, I know who is Purusha, I know who is Prakriti, I know the ego, I know the pure consciousness, everything is known to me at that point. That means I am self-realized. I know myself.
Self-aware.
Self-realization, they call it. Self-realization, right? That's the term they use. So, Viveka Khyati is self-realization. So by the practice of these eight limbs of yoga, first thing that will happen is that the impurities will go away. And with that, because of the impurities go away, I can now see that light of pure wisdom which was hidden, on which I had a cover on before that. Ego puts a cover on that. Doesn't let you see that light. He wants to keep you in darkness so that I can point fingers. Once that cover is removed, that all the impurities are removed, the ego, when the impurities are removed, ego doesn't know what to do. It sits back. Then I can see the light of that pure intuitive wisdom, prajna it's called. I can see that light coming through. Once I have that light, I can know who I am. I know my true identity. I have realized myself. I have become a pure viveki, as they call it. Viveki is the one who can who knows exactly what's what. With the perfect clarity of thought.
Slightly off topic question, but why do you recommend not eating non-veg or alcohol?
I don't. I don't recommend.
But during your classes,
you during the class, during the morning programs, this is based on some studies that I've read that both alcohol and eating of meat can impact your ability to meditate, your mind's thinking power. Alcohol, we know that it can confuse the mind. Meat is generally considered to be a very heavy diet. It's very heavy to digest. It's not easy to digest meat. Okay, and my, you know, guideline for these morning programs is that because it's something that I want to use as a form of transformation, and to bring that transformation out, let's go on a sattvic diet. Okay, and sattvic diet, I include not eating meat, only because from what I've read, it is very hard to digest, very, very hard to digest.
But yoga, I mean, Patanjali does not.
No, nowhere.
But it does, doesn't it? Patanjali doesn't talk about ahimsa.
Ahimsa, yes. Now, that not eating meat is in corollary to that, yes.
Right.
But in no text that I have seen, that I have read so far, I've read plenty of texts, I have not seen in any single text mentioned that don't eat meat. They all say don't do hinsa. They all say do ahimsa.
So eat without killing.
So ahimsa is there mentioned, right? Most people tend to translate that into not eating meat. Most people do that, especially in India. It's your own choice. I never tell anybody not to eat meat or not to eat, drink anything. It's during that program only I recommend when the 21 days, 42 days are over, do what you want to do. It's perfectly okay. Because I want to use that period as a form of transformation. And you have to make changes for your transformation. That's why I recommend that. Make changes. Get out of your comfort zone. Otherwise, I have nothing against it, you know. I drink myself every now and then, you know, I enjoy that. I don't eat meat, but I enjoy a drink every now and then. But not during these 21 days, no. Okay. No. Dipin is going through that these days. Okay. Mahi went through it last time.
Yeah, I felt it was just only 14 days, just 1 or 2 weeks.
Yeah, you did the 14-day program, yeah.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Which is different than the 21-14 program, right?
No, that was meditation.
Right.
Yeah, you were also there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you were there, yeah.
Yeah.
The 21 days is more asana focused, more focused on the physical part and pranayama. But I still want people to get that feel of transformation, transformational behavior pattern, you know. Otherwise, then I have nothing against it. You know, I don't tell anybody not to eat meat. Do what you enjoy.
But if that transformation has to stay on with that person,
it will stay on only if your intellect is propelling you. If your ego continues to propel you, then it won't stay.
Yeah. Then.
Then you come back for another course.
Then you continue. I mean, eating. I don't know. I'm not a proponent or opponent of eating meat or anything. So the whole idea is to go through the transformation. But
yes.
Then after that, if someone goes back to doing their own subhavam, that we say, right, so then the transformation is gone.
Yes, I agree with that. Yeah, that's the whole idea. The whole idea is to do this for 42 days, and you know that's supposed to keep the transformation more permanent. If you do something for 42 days, it says, you know, there's a possibility that it'll stay on.
It's not
the way, I guess memory says 42 days, maybe. So the ego cannot reach beyond 42 days.
Well, I mean, there's the common wisdom. Who knows who put that wisdom on paper, you know, I don't know, but that's what they say. It's common wisdom that 42 days will help you transform yourself. I don't know.
It must be written somewhere. A lot of religions follow that.
I know. Many religions follow that. Many, many statesmen, many religious teachers, they tell you that. But I have not seen it in a text that it is. But, you know, given that it is the common wisdom, I've taken that for these programs.
No, but even in Ayurveda, they treat 21 days like everything is
yes.
a 21 day course.
Everyone, I mean, you go to Art of Living, they say at least 42 days, you know, so, I mean, like I said, many people do that. So. Yeah, yeah. That's right. So that sutra is very, very beautiful. You know, that sutra that introduces the eight limbs of yoga. It's a very beautiful sutra. It kind of encapsulates the real, true benefit of yoga, that you will do a shuddhikshaye. That means all your impurities will be wiped out. You'll get the light of true wisdom, and you will become self-realized. Yes. So, it's a very beautiful statement. So that's how he introduces the concept of this eight limbs of yoga. Now, what are these eight limbs of yoga?
Anybody?
Yama, niyama. Asana, pranayama. Yamas, niyamas, asana, pranayama. Fifth one is pratyahara. Dharana. Dhyana. Samadhi. So these are the eight limbs of yoga. Yamas and niyamas are more like your social, ethical, moral guidelines.
Okay. Bible. Hmm? That's what all Bible is about. Day-to-day guidelines.
Day-to-day guidelines, yeah. That's right. So in Bible they say 10 commandments. Here we say 10 commitments. We don't say commandments, they are commitments that you make to yourself. That you will follow the guidelines of Yama and the guidelines of Niyama. What are the yamas? There are five of each. That's why there are 10. 10 commitments. What are the five yamas? Ahimsa, number one. Number two, top one. Ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahma. Asteya means non-stealing. Steya means stealing. Stena is a thief. Then as a thief, steya means to steal, and asteya means non-stealing. So there's ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya. Brahmacharya is?
Celibacy.
Celibacy. Non-indulgence in sexual, you know, acts or whatever. Excessive, I'm assuming that's what it is. Celibacy, that's another word for it. And then final yama is aparigraha. Graha is to grab things. Grahana, to grab things. Graha, greed. So parigraha is, you know, really desire to grab things. Parigraha. Aparigraha is no desire to grab onto things. So, non-greediness. Okay, that is aparigraha. So, there is ahimsa, which we all know. Satya. Asteya. Non-stealing. Brahmacharya. Sense control. Brahmacharya is control of the five senses. And aparigraha. Aparigraha is non-greediness, not having the tendency to grah or to hoard, H-O-A-R-D, hoard stuff. Take this, grab that, you know. Greediness. So the five yamas, so they are more like socially interactive guidelines. How do you interact with people? Then the five niyamas are more oriented to yourself. Self-discipline kind of things. What are these five niyamas? First one is shaucha. Shaucha means?
Cleanliness,
purity. Cleanliness is shaucha. Shaucha means cleanliness, purity of the body, purity of the mind, purity of the environment, surroundings, everything, all pure. That's shaucha. Then the next one is santosha. What's that?
Satisfaction,
happiness, contentment. Totally being contented with what you have. That is called santosha. So there is shaucha, santosha. Number three is tapas. What is tapas? Tapasya.
Focus, sir.
Tapasya. Have you heard of the word tapasya?
Yeah.
What is that?
Intense study of something.
Any intense practice. Tapasya. Tapas is... Tapa, it comes from the word tapa. Tapa is what? Tap, heat. Okay? It comes from heat. You're putting yourself through intense heat. You know, they always say, how do you purify gold? Put it through intense heat. You know? That's tapas. Tapas is to do something very, very intensely, you know. You put yourself through some intense situations so your body and mind become very, very tough. And you develop the ability to withstand all dualities of life. That's tapas.
Resilient. Hmm?
You should become totally very resilient. Being able to withstand the dualities of life. Dualities of life means all honor, dishonor, you know, people coming to attack you, people come and praise you, etc., etc. Hot, cold, all those dualities, good, bad.
Yin yang.
Yin yang. Okay, it's very true. So these dualities are the ones which cause all kinds of problems for us. And if we can learn how to stay balanced in the face of these dualities, then we have become a tapasvi. Okay? Those are the terms used. Tapas, tapasya. When we do tapasya, we become tapasvi. Okay? So that's tapas. So things like, you know, people say, okay, I'm going to fast every Monday. I will not eat anything. That's tapasya. Or I'm going to walk 5 miles every day. That's tapas. Or I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock every morning and do yoga for 2 hours. That's tapas. Or I'm going to sit for meditation for an hour every morning. That's tapas. Or I'm going to give to charity $100 every month, no matter what. That's tapas. Or I'm going to give up watching TV for a week. That's tapas. Or I'm going to do a phone fast. No phones for a week. I'm going to do an email fast for a week. That's tapas. Any kind of fast. Ego is not...
What kind of ego? Because you are determined to do something.
That's intellect. When you're determined to do something, that's intellect. That's called buddhi.
So...
Not the ego.
Kind of. There is a good ego too.
Right? Well, ego, like I said, you know, this again, depending on how you use these terms, but in the context of the yoga, Ego has only this function of giving you an identity. There is no other function for the ego. All the other stuff is done by the buddhi. Depending on how you look at these things, you know, some of the modern psychologists understand these things differently. I am giving you the terms that are generally used by our ancient texts. Okay.
They cannot be loosely translated to English.
No, they cannot be loosely translated, no. They have to be understood in the right context. Yeah.
Hatha Yoga has no connection with Patanjali.
That's not necessarily true. Hatha Yoga, if you read the Hatha Yoga Sutras, the very second shloka, that's very rare.
Yeah. Yesterday also it happened once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, the second shloka says that all the practices of Hatha Yoga that are mentioned in this text, their main purpose is to drive you to Raja Yoga, which is Patanjali's yoga. And the eventual goal of all Hatha Yoga practices is to eventually go towards Raja Yoga. Raja Yoga is another term for Patanjali's yoga.
But that's not a prerequisite as such.
Hmm?
Hatha Yoga is not a prerequisite to Patanjali yoga, right?
No, it's not a prerequisite, no. It's not. But it became a prerequisite because of the need. See, what happened was Patanjali says, sit and meditate. That's all he said, right? He didn't say anything else. He didn't say do warrior pose and headstand or shoulder stand. He didn't say any of that. All he said is to sit and meditate. And when people started meditating, that's when problems began to happen. Because when you sit for meditation, after 5 minutes, my knees would hurt, my shoulders would sag, my spine hurts, I cannot sit straight, my buttocks hurt. And things just didn't work out. And I'm in pain, how can I meditate on my God or Ishvara or whoever I'm meditating on? There's no way. And that is how this whole science of Hatha Yoga evolved. They had to develop something which would make the body strong and comfortable enough so that you can sit and meditate without pain. So that's why Hatha Yoga Pradipika, he says that this whole purpose of this practice is so that you can eventually sit and meditate and follow Patanjali's guidelines. It's not a prerequisite, but if you cannot sit, then by need, it becomes a prerequisite.
It's an enabler.
It's an enabler.
But that's what Patanjali also says, right? The asana part of it.
Asana means what?
To make your body strong.
No. Asana means what? Asana means comes. It comes from the word as. Root word is as. As means to sit. Asana can mean two things. It's either the sitting posture or what you're sitting on. This seat, for example, this chair is my asana at this time. I'm sitting on this chair.
No, the yoga asana, the yoga practices that we do.
That's Hatha Yoga.
That is Hatha Yoga?
That's Hatha Yoga. That practices that we do in the class here, that is Hatha Yoga. All the sitting poses, standing poses, inversion poses, that's all Hatha Yoga.
Okay. So Yoga Sutras do not have
any. Yoga Sutras is all, asana in Yoga Sutras simply means sit. That's it.
Oh, I thought the asana reference is to the postures.
Not the Hatha Yoga. Okay. Literal meaning of asana is to sit down. That's it. All Patanjali wanted you to do was to sit down and meditate.
If you can.
And the evolution of Hatha Yoga came about because people could not sit for any length of time. So those are the concepts of tapas. Oh, I didn't finish the five niyamas. So the shaucha is cleanliness. Santosha is contentment. Tapas is, they call it austerity, you know. That's the English word. My mind is toughening up, you know, just get tough, man. Tapas. Then the next one is Swadhyaya. Swadhyaya is to study yourself or study the scriptures and understand the the truth about yourself. And finally, Ishvara Pranidhana, that's the term he used, introduced. Ishvara Pranidhana, surrender to Ishvara, surrender to the Supreme Being, so to say. Get rid of your ego. Okay? So those are the five yamas and niyamas. Then asana, we just talked about it. Pranayama, we do it all the time. That's all the breathing practices. Okay. Pratyahara is to turn the senses inward. That means you're not going to be bothered by the inputs received by the five senses. That's called pratyahara. And then finally, three are the stages of meditation. First is dharana, initial focus. Then dhyana, which is all the practices of meditation. And then samadhi, where your mind has now been brought to a single focal point without distraction. That's samadhi. So you practice these eight limbs of yoga, Patanjali says, then you'll reach a state eventually which he calls kaivalya. Comes from kevala. Kevala means isolation or independence or freedom or liberation. That means now the purusha, which was so far tied up with the ego, has been liberated. Okay, so this Atma has now become free of any identification with the ego and then the Prakriti, basically. All aspects of Prakriti. And once that happens, then you are fat, dumb and happy, as they say. No worries. And nothing can bother you. Then you don't need to raise your finger at anybody. It may not happen. It will not happen in one life. But what you will find is, amazingly, that even though that final state may not happen in one life, but you can attain so many other benefits in one life. Amazing benefits. That calmness and clarity of thought, it begins to, you can start feeling that. You can actually start feeling that clarity of thinking after practicing yoga. Less confusion in your mind, less confusion in your behaviors. Your behavior pattern changes, your relationships change, a lot of things happen once you start practicing yoga. Yeah. Even in that simple, 14-day class, one person said that, when we do the final sitting down and evaluation, we give feedback to everybody. One of them said that, look, my kids are complaining, how come I don't shout at them anymore? This happened after 14 days only. So I've stopped shouting at the kids without my knowing. It's my kids who tell me that I don't shout at them anymore. So things happen. So just because the final goal may not be achieved in many lifetimes, it doesn't mean that you don't get a start. Because once you get a start, a lot of things happen on the way.
So is there any mentioning of the purusha, like the soul? Does the soul remember everything from all the lives?
So what happens is, I started on that, but we never completed that thought. So there's this sthula sharira, physical, gross body, and the subtle body. It's the subtle body which is the carrier of this bag of karmas and all the memories and all the vasanas, everything that is collected, gathered in this lifetime, that goes into what Patanjali calls karmashaya. Ashaya is this bag, is this whole bank balance, so to say, bag full of your karmas. Karmas include everything, your actions, the expected results of these actions, and whether they are good actions, bad actions, and what kind of desires you have, what kind of thoughts you have. Everything is a part of this sukshma sharira. And because of this identification, this soul is actually, it's all attached to the soul. So when the human body dies, when the physical body dies, this sukshma sharira, this subtle body, which is this atma along with this, all this stuff, karmashaya, that gets eventually attached to a different physical body after some time. That's called rebirth or reincarnation. And that's why it carries all that karma share with it. It carries all the memories and everything. And it carries the karmas, you know. So all the good deeds we did, all the bad deeds we did, and that's, you know, that will determine where do you take birth and what kind of situation you are in, etc., etc. All that is determined by the by this entire philosophy of rebirth and karma. I don't know enough about it, but but that's what they say.
And the prakriti is inbuilt in the body, the physical body.
Prakriti is this body is prakriti. This mind is prakriti, this intellect is prakriti, everything is prakriti. Prakriti is a composite of all this. Okay. So this is, in a nutshell, is the essence of the Yoga Sutras. And like I said, we were going one sutra at a time, going into depth. And we were at the very last end of this discussion after almost 2 years, I think, now. And we were discussing...
Once every month,
yeah. Every month on the third Saturday. Yeah. And actually, last time we had a brief discussion as to what we want to do after we are done with this session. If everyone is back next month, I'll finish that whole discussion, the last few sutras that are there. And somebody mentioned last time that we want to do Bhagavad Gita. You mentioned that. So that's one thought.
I'm interested in the sutras from the beginning.
We can do that. So. So all depends.
I will miss next time. I'm going to be traveling next month.
Well, that's okay. We'll see what we do. So there are two thoughts. One is to spend some time understanding the Bhagavad Gita. That's one thought. The second, obviously, is to recycle this whole program. Right from the beginning, go sutra by sutra. One sutra at a time. And that's the second thought. So you are interested in the sutras? Oh, I see.
Whenever I have time, I would love to come.
Right, okay.
I'm okay with the sutras also.
I'm
okay with the sutras also, if you want to restart, because I have missed the whole initial part.
Well, I mean, I'm going to go through one by one, you know, that's one sutra at a time. We go through every single word. So we recite the sutra in Sanskrit, then I break it apart, and we get the meaning of every single word from Sanskrit to English or any other, you know, way we can understand, and then we try to see what it means. That's what we've been doing.
That's good.
One sutra at a time.
So if it is like 1.5 to 2 years, it's like 18 to 24 sessions, 2 hours each that we do.
Yeah. That's what it takes, you know. Because if you go sutra by sutra, it takes time sometimes, you know. There are times when I do only 2 sutras in that whole session. That's what it is. Let's finish the whole thing first. You know, I have a few sutras and then I will spend one more session just to summarize everything, just like we did today. I would like to do it one more time, if others are present, when others are present. And that way we'll wrap up, and also we'll have question answers, you know, that session, one final session. And you can have random questions, not necessarily related.